Do you see he called out Tyson Fury? He's like, I'll bare knuckle box you, mate.
Because I'm a fighting man. And I'll shoot in the face because I'm a fighting man. Yeah, I think that whole situation is just getting a bit like up in the air now, because obviously Fury's fighting Dillian White. That's just been announced. They're going to go to Wembley. Tickets go on sale this coming Wednesday. That's up in the air whether we're going to go to that. And apparently Usyk's training camp, which is outside of Kiev, you can't go there now, isn't it? So
yeah.
And their rematch, him and AJ, is supposed to be June time. And AJ's looking for new trainers himself, so there's a lot of moving parts to that potential rematch.
Yeah, Russian Grand Prix. Yeah,
I didn't even know they did a Grand Prix in Russia.
Yeah, this year's Formula One Russian Grand Prix is supposed to happen in September. It's been cancelled. Did you guys hear about the ghost of Kiev? You heard this about this dude?
No.
Apparently, there's this dude, like a fighter pilot, and on day one yesterday when he attacked Kiev, he shot down six Russian fighter jets in aerial dogfights. But I looked into it a bit more, and it looks like it's just bullshit. But it's a cool story, though. They call him the Ghost of Kiev.
Oh, I love it.
Going on like Baron von Richthofen or whatever it was.
Yeah, the Red Baron.
His dog Moritz, good German geezer, used to carry his dog in the cockpit or whatever it was.
Is that the Red Baron?
Yeah.
They're comparing him to him. Like, because if you have a story about a dude like that, it's going to shit you up. Like, oh, they've got this fucking mad geezer and they're playing with a dog and he fucks up everyone.
The ghost of Kiev. You shouldn't be laughing, man. Fucking hell. Serious shit.
Yeah, it is.
Isn't it?
Got one for you as well, Flint. Apparently, we're meant to say, we're not meant to say Kiev, because that's the Russian pronunciation of the city. I meant to say Kiev, Kiev with a Kiev. Y, and spell it with a Y, because that's the Ukrainian spelling and pronunciation of it.
Ah, there you go. Nice. I like that, man.
But the thing is, history is written by the winners, mate. So I'm gonna say Kiev, innit? I'm gonna hedge my bets. That's why I'm learning Mandarin, mate. If shit goes down, I know what fucking side my bread's buttered. It's a bit much, innit? I've actively avoided all the war stuff because I don't want to engaging it on an entertainment level, you know, it's fucked.
Ah, I love that.
You know, something new every day.
I love a little language fact, me, man.
And it? Naves.
No, you stunk, man. I just stunk out this whole room with one burp.
What have you eaten?
I had
chicken Kievs.
Chicken Kiev. Ryan wants a biscuit. Fuck it. Yeah, just something smelly. Let's just get on.
Yeah, just go over it. So, I mean, this week we're going to be rounding up the Premier League and Champions League, obviously including that City versus Spurs game and Conte and where his sort of direction as the Spurs head coach goes in the foreseeable future. Leeds are in complete free fall at the minute. We're going to have a word about them and Bielsa and whether he's the right man for the job. And then in our featured fights, we have got the Brook versus Khan review and the preview of Josh Taylor versus Jack Carroll, which I'm sure you're looking, you're very interested in and looking forward to this weekend, Jim.
I've been watching the build-up, the Gloves Are Off episode and the final press conference and the weigh-in today. Both fighters made weight. Jack Catterall came in 139, a pound under the limit. Josh Taylor came in 140 on the money. Looked very, very drawn in the face. Got a bit feisty in the final face-off. They were grabbing each other's throats, had to be separated. The first indication that Catterall's really charged up for this fight. He's kept a very practiced, measured countenance in the build-up to this. Josh Taylor's been at him the whole time. We're on the brink now. This was a one-sided fight for me, but the build-up has definitely brought some more intrigue.
Yeah, it'd be good to get some more in-depth analysis of that a bit later on. So we'll start off with the prem roundup. We'll just go over some of the results since we last spoke on the podcast. Manchester United beat Leeds 4-2 in what was kind of like... Did any catch this game? It was the most Sunday League Premier League game of football I've ever seen. They're just like slide tackles galore because of the weather. Oh, they were just loving it, man. Just, you know, like, you remember that Boris Johnson slide in, the Sol Campbell one. Don't know why I said Boris Johnson.
he's the one that did
the rugby tackle, but the Sol Campbell slide where he kept on sliding forever and they made that meme out of it. it was like that, man. They just loved it. They were just gliding across the surface. But Leeds just extremely leaky defensively once again. I think they have the second worst defensive record in the Premier League at the minute. Wolves, another great result. Obviously, they beat Tottenham 2-0. Then they went and beat Leicester 2-1 on Sunday. Newcastle got a good away point at West Ham. Their resurgence under Eddie Howe continues. And then Arsenal, I think we spoke about Arsenal yesterday. They beat Brentford 2-1. And then obviously they won 2-1 yesterday, beat that Wolves team that we just spoken about with a last minute goal from Lacazette. I mean, you got to be chuffed with what's going on, at Arsenal and under Arteta, considering, at the start of the season, we were really worried about them, even sort of staying in the Premier League at one point and let alone fighting for that top four. So, Jim, you got to be well chuffed about it.
I actually did believe losing to Brentford on the opening day, I was thinking, fucking hell, we're going to be scrapping for our lives down there. But West Ham have been surging. United have been there or thereabouts, kind of underwhelming. But coming from behind against Wolves, who, as you said, are a proper team, beating Leicester last week, and especially avenging that loss from the opening day against Brentford. Good run so far. Odegaard's looking good. Pepe started to do bits after being in and out all season. Lacazette, what can you say, man? Last grasp winner. Although you have to admit it was a bit of a fortunate finish. A bit of a scuffed attempt. It looked like it was going more across goal, but putting together those quick succession of passes in the box at that stage in the game, is it enough to say he earned his luck there? Maybe. I'm just happy he got the result, man.
Flynn, what do you make of Steven Gerrard's performance now after we've had, the sort of first, couple of months to reflect on his performance as a whole? Obviously, he started like a house on fire and then it really has started to slide. The performances, I think, haven't been as good as they were when he first came into the club. And now the results aren't going his way either. Obviously, they lost at home 1-0 on the weekend to Watford. Roy Hodgson, the great owl, his Watford team, who's 75 years old? What is he doing still in football management? Anyway, but 1-0 to them. And it's another defeat for Aston Villa. I think there's only one win in six now, is it, or something?
It looks like they've had one win in the last five, at least. It could very well be the last six. I'm gutted about it. I had huge high hopes. I thought Stevie G was going to break the whole honeymoon, honeymoon phenomenon that we've been talking about most weeks in this podcast. So I'm personally gutted. I thought he was going to be the man to bust that myth. It looks like they're down in 13th at the moment now. Does anyone see them pulling it back? Or what do you think? Has he lost this momentum? Can he get it back? Or is the hype just a one-time thing?
I can see him I can't see him getting into a legitimate relegation scrap. But losing 1-0 to Watford, especially with the struggles they've been having this season, that's not a good indicator as to where the team's at. On a personality basis, on a achievement basis, it's hard to pick against Stevie G. But at the same time, downward momentum in the Premier League is an especially damaging habit to get into. On a side note, the team that Stevie G left, Rangers, recorded probably the best victory of their, last 20, 25 years against Dortmund, winning the whole tie, winning 4-2 away, then drawing 2-2, should have been 3-2 really, probably one of the more famous results in that club's history. So big up to them and Van Bronckhorst, who took the helm after Stevie G left. And you have to give credit to Stevie G for laying that infrastructure up there to give the team the chance to go on and achieve that sort of result. He hasn't had a lot of time at Villa. And I would urge them to give him more time, even if they finish 15th or something. I hope they do give him a fair shot next season.
Yeah, I think it's fairly obvious that he's going to continue as manager, at least to the start of next season. There's always that transitional period. We're going to speak a bit later about sort of Bielsa and sort of the difference between English managers and foreign coaches and how much time they get given and maybe how much leeway they get in terms of performances not coming straight away. But you can be fairly certain that Villa will finish the season with Gerrard as manager. But a lot of the clubs around that bottom three got really positive results. Burnley won 3-0 away at Brighton. Wouter Weghorst, who I knew was going to be a good signing for them. He's 30 years of age. He's been smashing it in the Bundesliga for a Werder Bremen, I think he was at, or Wolfsburg, one of the two. For the last couple of years, man, he's been scoring like really, really consistently, you know, high tallies of goal scoring. I think at least sort of, you know, 12 plus over the last couple of seasons. And I think that's a really good signing for them. And obviously they signed, Maxwell Cornet, the Ivory Coast international, I think came from Ligue 1. And obviously they've got a few good players around. Josh Brownell's coming through. He's doing really well. Dwight Neal's, he's been injured quite a lot over the last couple of years, but he's doing really well there. So, I mean, that's a fantastic result for Burnley. So, you know, obviously Norwich lost 3-1 to Liverpool. They were 1-0 up for quite a long period of that game. And then obviously, Liverpool came true in the end. Everton, Frank Lampard, obviously he's had 3 games now. 2 losses out of those. The other one was a 3-0 victory against Leeds, which, you know, after the way Leeds have been playing over the, you know, and their injury concerns, it's looking, it's not looking as good as a result as it did initially. So, you know, who do you think realistically out of those teams now around the bottom half of the table, you know, who do you think could go down?
Leeds are looking like free-falling like Tom Petty. Norwich have been stuck down there for ages, so I'd have to say Norwich, really. Watford, is 13 games enough to get you up there? It's hard to say. Man, could Burnley look like they're turning it around? Newcastle look like they're turning it around. Everton, not sure about them. Leeds look like they're free-falling. If I had to pick 3, I would go Norwich, Leeds and Watford. Those are my 3 relegation candidates.
If I was going to say, I'd say Norwich. Is that just 4 wins they've had this season? They've got
to
be
terrible. Gone. They're terrible, man.
Last two
were losses, I think.
So the last 5 games has been 2 wins, a draw and 2 losses.
From the left-hand side, yeah.
Okay. So Norwich have got to be going down. I think Watford, I don't know, I know we're hyping up Burnley a little bit, but it might be too late for them to pull it back. I don't know. Just 3 wins so far. I'm going to say the 3 teams currently at the bottom, they're going down. That's my hot take.
There's only 6 points separating the bottom 5 teams. You know, it's very, very close. All the way up to Crystal Palace in 11th. Like, that's only, 12 points? Loads can happen. 13 games left. We've seen it before, man. Teams, they go on mad runs at the end of the season, stringing together wins when they haven't been able to do it for the rest of the time. So,
just clocked your name at the bottom, Peter File. Did you see that, Blin?
I didn't catch that.
Fucking hell.
I'm Hello, Peter File.
I was very, very tempted to put that on the inclusion and diversity course I was on earlier for the BFI, but I thought, nah, man, I'll just put my actual name.
I think Everton, they're definitely going to have too much quality, aren't they? You'd think so to go down. Norwich, yeah, you'd have to assume that they're going to drop out of it. It's going to be an interesting run at the end of the season. See who gets relegated. We'll talk about matters at the other end of the table because obviously, I keep on saying obviously this week, I don't know, that's just the word that I keep on saying this week. Man City, it's all been broken open, isn't it? Liverpool, they've just been brilliant over the last few games, scoring goals for fun. And Spurs beating Man City, they're only winning the last 5, I think losing the other 4, has really blown the title race wide open. And this was really a game that really revolved around Harry Kane and how good he was. And we haven't said that enough this season, really. And we criticised him in an England shirt for dropping deep. And we spoke quite a lot about the tactical instructions that he was getting from maybe his coach at Tottenham, whether it be Santo or whether it be Pochettino, whether it be Conte, and also maybe what Southgate was instructing him to do. But he played that deep line striker role like brilliantly against Man City, absolutely flawless. And as Jim said in the WhatsApp group, he was pinging it about like Iniesta, man. Like the way he was playing his long balls and the sort of the decisive cut through balls, you know, into Son, into Kulusevski, who had a good opening, good first game for Tottenham, scored, 4 minutes into his debut. But he was really like dictating the play from those positions. And that wasn't even, you know, I was going to say that's his best performance of the season, but I was looking at the Who Scored ratings earlier. And he had a 9.34 against Leicester. That was that was in January. But this was as close as it was at 8.68, the rating they gave him. But I thought he was brilliant. And, you know, he really should have had a hat trick. I think it was only a marginal offside call that prevented that. But did either of you watch his game?
I didn't catch it, but I just wanted to point out that obviously this has been another hot take from the Ball Chat Sports podcast. We shit on Harry Kane all the time. We said Man City, no one would ever catch them. And now look at us. But yeah, over to you, Jim. What was your take on that?
We're manifesting reality. Anything we say, the opposite occurs. It's actually nuts how often that happens. But Harry Kane's pass for the first goal was ridiculous. First time, literally cutting through the Man City defence, releasing Son. Yeah, we did criticise Kane for coming deep because he's a high-level striker. He's wasted in the middle of the field. But if he's got that kind of passing vision and dexterity, and you've got runners like Son and your man's name, who are still Kulusevski, Chicken Kievski. So yeah, if you've got that kind of support from your attacking players, he's well utilized. But in a more contextual picture, that's Tottenham's only win in the last 5 games. It's mad that they were able to pull it out against City, who were looking like this unmovable force. And I can't believe that only 3 points separate City and Liverpool now. That is bonkers, isn't it, really? But City did, they bounced back, didn't they, with a win? Oh, no, that was the last game. That was the last game, wasn't it? Bit mad now. So what do you think, Bissett? Could you say this is just a blip at an inopportune moment for City? Or is it indicative of something bigger happening? Do you see the momentum actually swinging and favouring Liverpool?
Well, as you say, we were writing Liverpool off, essentially, weren't we? Not even 6 weeks ago. I think the gap was 10 points. And I don't even know how it's closed, really. I can't think of
that's what I'm thinking of.
Like, how has that one result like changed so much? I thought it was like 8 points. I thought it was like basically everyone was saying, you know, the league's title's been handed to Man City.
I think they had 2 or 3 games in hand and they've won all of them, and then City drew one and lost one. So that closed the gap there. But yeah, I'm just as shocked as you that it's come down this close. So now you've got to think, like, Pep's going to be battling on all fronts. We know he's obsessed with winning the Champions League with City. But now Liverpool are breathing down his neck. It's high drama.
Are we calling it right now? Liverpool winning?
Yeah, City are definitely going to win if we say that. So
I was going to say, let's not call anything when it's this close, to be fair. But what did you make of Antonio Conte and his response to Tottenham's 4th defeat in 5 games? You know, his reaction to that?
He was defeated, wasn't he? He said, there's obviously going to be questions about me. Like, they're going to have to assess my ability as a coach. On one hand, I felt like that's quite an open, honest assessment, because everyone knows that's the truth. If you're sliding the way Tottenham are sliding and you've got the reputation that he's got, he's obviously going to come under scrutiny. But at the same time, I've come to expect a kind of bluster from managers, protecting themselves, protecting the players. He just looked like someone who, if he gets the axe, he's happy to take his payment and bounce, really. It's not the most encouraging sign as a Spurs fan, to be honest. But do you want someone who's going to have fake bluster, fake bravado? Or do you want someone who seems like they're actually accepting the situation for what it is? What would you prefer?
I think in coaches across all sports, we get this sort of coach speak, don't we? And they almost speak in a template. after games, you know, in these post-match interviews, it does follow a sort of template, and they're very, very shrewd about what they say. They keep things very close to their chest. And it was quite refreshing to see Conte come out and be like, well, like, you know, I'm not sure if I'm the right man for the job. Because it's usually the other way around, isn't it? It's usually that, you know, we'll be criticizing a manager saying, oh, he's not the right man for the job. You know, he's deluded kind of thing. Like, there's no way they're going to get out of this rut. But he just came out and was forward and said, like, it's not working at the minute. I feel like I'm putting in 20-hour days, what he was saying. Literally, the other 4 hours, I'm just sleeping. So he was like upfront about his effort and his work ethic. But he was just saying things aren't clicking at the moment, which I think is fair enough. Sometimes, you know, in short spans of game and, you know, a small sample of data, like five games, things just might not go your way, especially in, you know, in the Premier League with a certain level of quality that there is. Like, you will get games where things will go your way, and that'll be the difference between taking 3 points home and taking like 0 points home. Do you know what I mean? So there can be very fine margins in the Premier League at an elite level. So I think I wouldn't say that Daniel Levy and the rest of the board are going to, you know, sort of jump to conclusions and think that, all right, maybe he's not the right man for the job. I do think they probably had a conversation over the last couple of days about the direction that they want to go in. Possibly he's been given an ultimatum. And he's, you know, he's been given, say, three games in which to get results. I don't know. But he's a high profile, very, you know, well-respected manager. So, you know, I don't think the right avenue for Tottenham is to sack him at the minute, because obviously they had Nuno for, what was it, 17 games that we mentioned. Conte's only had three or four more games than that. If they do sack him now, what are Tottenham realistically expecting to get? Because I don't think they're going to get top four. I think that's out of the question now. So it's either Europa League or Europa Conference League that they're playing for. So I don't see the point in them getting rid of Conte. Let him have the rest of the season. Let's see if results improve. Finally, they can get some stability. Hopefully get back to what they were like under Pochettino when they were very successful, got to the Champions League final, I think finished second. So, you know, they had a lot of success under Pochettino. I think they want to get back to that. So let him finish the season. Let's see if he can build and start embedding his philosophy, his tactics and his system, and start getting the players, you know, moving in the same direction.
It seems to me that he doesn't want to stay. I've got a feeling that Tottenham want to keep him, but it looks to me that he's already putting feelers out to go. I saw a quote in the Mirror today from former Serie A star turned agent Massimo Brambati. He claims that Conte is now considering his future at Tottenham Hotspur. He said on TMW Radio, he said he's thinking of leaving. He would like to stay at home. Let's say. So it looks like he's putting out feelers to go back to Italy, I reckon. For me, so he carries on. He says, for me, he overestimated the situation, which he then found himself managing. The results didn't help him, not only those on the pitch, but also the response of the players. It takes time, and maybe he realised that there's a margin beyond which he can't go with certain players. He made a wrong assessment. I've heard from him. He's disappointed with a situation he expected to be different. So that says to me, he's leaking things to people back in Italy that he wants to go home.
Yeah, definitely. But also it says that it suggests that he went to Tottenham with a certain expectation about the quality of players and the quality of the squad, which you can imagine is probably the case. He's been a top-level manager for a long time, got to Tottenham and was like, these lads ain't all that really. You know what I mean? Which he's probably like, fucking hell, I've been sold some magic beans here. But also, if you look at the Premier League table, Tottenham are in eighth place at the minute. If you look at the teams above them, only West Ham and Wolves really stand out as being anomalous. The other teams, City, Liverpool, Chelsea, United and Arsenal, more or less, they're always going to be above Spurs the way things stand. So what more can they realistically expect unless they absolutely revamp 70% of their squad? Huge cash injection. Do you know what I mean? Like, General Levy, he doesn't seem like the kind of guy to make like rash decisions like that. So I don't know what they're planning for. It's like you said, Bissett, probably Europa League, isn't it, realistically?
And Conte, I think he's probably disappointed with the lack of investment in January as well. They bought that Kulusevski in on loan. I'm not sure if they signed Bentancur, but I haven't seen any performances or any really much about him at all. So they didn't really improve the squad in January. That has to be said. They got rid of Dele Alli, brought in Kulusevski and Rodrigo Bentancur. Who else did they get rid of? Did they get rid of another player? But they just haven't really invested in the squad. And you know, it's very, very difficult to compete with Man City, with Liverpool, with Chelsea. Well, it's impossible to compete with those teams without investing heavily and bringing in some of the best players in the world. You cannot compete with them because Man City have just got too much firepower, too much resources, same as Liverpool. Do you know what I mean? They've got players that are on the fringes of their team, like Divock Origi, like Minamino, and then the new lad they brought in. They brought in Diogo Jota from Wolves like last season. So it's just they've got firepower all over the pitch, same as Man City. So there's no way they're going to compete on that level unless, as you say, Jim, they invest heavily. So let's see what happens with Conte. It does sound like he wants to leave, but you know, obviously there's going to be a big compensation package if Spurs were to get rid of him. So
they're not really known for spending a lot, though, are they, Tottenham? Do you think it's going to happen now?
Not under the same owners, unless they sell them off to some vanity fucking hair salesman conglomerate based in China. Look.
I think Harry Kane, I think maybe Daniel Levy was regretting not selling him to Man City 140 million. And I think after that performance against Man City, I think Man City was sort of ruining not signing him for another 40 million that they could have spent, that they spent on Jack Grealish, who really hasn't matched his price tag as of yet at Man City, and they could have had Kane for 140. I think that would have been a game change, really. I'm not sure we'd be talking about Man City and Liverpool being in the hunt for the Premier League title at this stage, should Harry Kane have gone to Man City. What do you think?
It's difficult to say, man, because remember when they sold Bale to Real Madrid, what was that, like 100 million? They reinvested in like four or five players. And at the time, or immediately after, I remember them being a certain backlash against that. But then, as you say, a season or two later, they're finishing second in the Premier League and then getting to the Champions League final, albeit under a very talented manager in Pochettino. So the reinvestment in all areas of the pitch, if properly applied, can work wonders. I think they're definitely regretting that at the minute. I mean, are they in a worse position right now than they would have been had they sold Kane? I don't think so, really. You know, I mean, I know he's a crucial player, but if you get in like two midfielders and two attackers to compensate for that, obviously Kane takes a few knocks here and there as well. He's not a one-man band. So I think the reinvestment, the strengthening of the squad overall probably would have helped, but I honestly think they'd be in pretty much the same position. The only thing they've done is take away a top-level player from one of their competitors, which is, you know, value in itself.
I think potentially Harry Kane is still going to go. Should Tottenham finish outside the Champions League places this season, he will move on. I don't think you can keep a player of that calibre, even though he hasn't performed as well as we know he can this season. He still managed, what, 7 goals in 22 appearances, for, I think, 4 assists so far. You know, he's had a very good performance last out. But he's not going to stay there. You know, it's impossible to keep a player of that quality at a team that isn't consistently getting Champions League football, because that's what the best players in the world want to play. They want to play in the highest stage, and that is the Champions League. We'll talk about things at the other end of the table. Obviously, Leeds, a team who we mentioned earlier, were in free fall. And I think the fans, the Leeds fans, have been really quite loyal to Bielsa in terms of their support. So many football fans are quite fickle when it comes to the managers. And Jim, you're going to raise the point about sort of where Leeds were prior to Bielsa coming in and where they are now, which is going to be a fair one. But the point I saw raised on Twitter was that if Bielsa was an English manager, would he still even be in the position as Leeds manager at the moment, or would he have been sacked months ago? So I think you do find that there's a certain allure when it comes to foreign managers, especially German managers at the minute. And we spoke about that on the podcast a few months ago as well. That there is a sort of, I don't know, a fetish for German managers. But obviously, Bielsa, coming from South America, he came with a lot of a high regard, really, from a lot of other coaches around the Premier League, held in really high esteem by the likes of Pep Guardiola, and Diego Simeone. But yeah, what do you think? Is there sort of a preconception that foreign managers get more time than English managers, do you think?
You know, I'm not 100% sure on that. It wasn't my preconception, but I haven't examined, you know, length of tenures, English versus foreign managers. I don't know if the data bears that out, but it certainly wasn't the way I viewed it. Probably the opposite, to be honest with you. But we did speak last week about the importance of name value for every manager in the Premier League, evidenced by what we've just talked about with Conte, even though that's results aren't going his way. He's had more time than his predecessor. There's a lot of moving parts to it. But Bielsa, as you've said, with the esteem that he's garnered in the game as a whole from people like Guardiola, he certainly has that name value. And I think we've got to consider contextually how low Leeds United actually were before their resurgence in recent years. Financial mismanagement of the club in the early 2000s saw them sell their best players, including Rio Ferdinand and Jonathan Woodgate. That couldn't prevent them going into relegation, administration, and suffering a 10-point deduction that landed them in league. And I know Leeds fans can't be happy with getting walloped 6-0 by Liverpool. And let's be fair, they've had a few heavy nights this season. I think on the opening day, Man United absolutely fucked them up. I think it was like 5-1 or something like that very early in the season. They've had a few beatdowns like that. They've recently lost to Everton, who, like, they're stuttering themselves. So in the grand scheme of things, Leeds, they're under the cosh, but they're in a far better place than they have been in recent years. And I think Bielsa is emblematic of that improvement. And I think that's part of the reason why he still has a job.
Yeah, and I think part of the reason he has a job as well is because of this, you know, his tactical game model, this high-intensity press style that he has employed really successfully in the Championship. But as we know, the gulf in quality between the Championship and the Premier League is massive. And it's very, very difficult to sustain that way of playing. And I think part of the problem with their injury concerns has to be related back to the way he trains and the way that he expects, or the amount that he expects of the players, and the sort of like load management that he doesn't really employ. And obviously there's a lot of sports that do use this term load management now, basketball being the biggest one that I can think of, just because they have so many games in such a short amount of time. They can be playing sort of four or five games a week sometimes. And it's about, you know, managing the fitness levels and the injury concerns that players might have. And I think this is a serious consideration for teams in the Premier League. Obviously, we hear about, oh, we're going to give that player a rest. We don't hear that as much now in the Premier League, really, with these like sort of elite level machines, which is what they are essentially, isn't it? You know, they're not like the players of 20 years ago that would go for 4 pints and a, you know, 10 pack of fags after the game. Like these players, a lot of them are teetotal. A lot of them have got nutritionists and, you know, they're in the gym every day. They have personal trainers. They're always constantly working on their body to make sure that they're at optimal levels of performance, ready to play the game. But I do think that his style of play and what he expects on the training pitch has definitely led itself to the injury concerns that they've had for at least the last 12 months, man. They haven't had a sort of like a free injury table for a long time. And that aside, tactically, he's been criticised by Gabriel Bonhall, I think today or yesterday on TalkSport. And he was saying that, you know, he's seen Sunday league managers that are better tacticians than Bielsa. And obviously that's an massive exaggeration. But if you look at a couple of the goals from that game against Liverpool, and of course, teams like Liverpool are going to be able to, you know, sort of dissect you fairly easily. But if you look at Leeds' second goal, and they've had lots of injury concerns and they're having to play players out of position, I think Pascal Struijk, who came in as a midfielder, has probably played centre-back more than he should have. I think he's played in both positions quite a lot this season. He sort of makes a grave mistake of stepping to the ball when Joel Matip, he sort of carries the ball through the midfield. And then it's just really sort of basic principles. Adam Forshaw doesn't press the ball carrier, which is Joel Matip. He plays a simple 1-2 with Salah into the gap that Pascal Struijk, left behind. And it's just like, that is basic things. But, you know what I mean? That is really, really simple football tactics. So do you blame the manager for not ensuring that Pascal Struyck's instructions about where he should be when that situation occurs. Is that down to Bielsa or is that down to the individual? Because that's going to be a big thing when it comes to the decisions that the board have to make about keeping Bielsa in his job.
But the thing is, we don't know the specific instructions that Bielsa is giving to his players. I've just watched a replay of that goal. It only takes a moment, a lapse in concentration, a split-second mistake for Liverpool to play a relatively simple 1-2 and split you wide open. That's just football, isn't it? You know, and Liverpool, they're the type of team that are primed and ready to jump on every single mistake you make. They're like City like that, do you know what I mean? Chelsea, they're the same. They're going to jump all over it. So, of course, the players bear some responsibility. Of course, the manager does. It's impossible to disentangle who's responsible, who's to blame. You can't even say that one player is fully responsible because you don't know what he's been told. Okay, like he might have made a basic mistake from a spectator's perspective, but he might have been trying to cut out danger before it even occurred. But obviously, Liverpool are on that next level and they've got the players that can punish you for it. So I would veer away from trying to pinpoint blame. The fact is, Leeds as a team and as a unit and as an organisation, they're in deep trouble right now. The question is, how do you stop this rot? How do you stop this downward momentum, this spiral, when you've got so many injuries, when morale's low, when people are questioning your manager? You know, how this is, you know, this is the big leagues, man. This is under the bright lights. This is the pressure of the job. This is why managers get multi-million pound contracts and players get paid what they do, because it's hot under them lights, man. And I don't envy them at all.
Well, look, what a manager will do traditionally in the Premier League when they come into a new job and they're taking over a team that are really struggling in the league, what do they do? What is the first thing they do? They get back to basics. And I think what I've got an issue with is with what Bielsa is doing is he's sticking to his principles no matter what. No matter what personnel he has available, no matter which team that he's playing, he wants to stick to his philosophy. And there's a certain part of me that thinks, you know what? Well on him. No matter what the situation is, he's always going to stick by his principles. But there's another side of me also says that I think that's quite ignorant.
It's foolhardy, man.
It is a little bit, isn't it? Because you need to make sure that you adapt the situation to the team that you're playing and the circumstances that you're under. So if you haven't got two fit centre backs, or you haven't got two fit, wing backs, I think he's only got a Junior Firpo, left back that he signed from Barcelona, who's had an absolutely shocking season, by the way. He's the only sort of senior left back at the club. And I think the only right back they've got at the club is Luke Ayling, who had to play centre back against Liverpool. So you have to try and adapt to the situation, and especially when you're playing a team like Liverpool, like it's not going to work. Like full press isn't going to work the whole game. They're just going to cut you apart. They really are. So you need to think about your tactics, and you need to adjust it based on the opposition. And I don't think he's been doing that.
It's good you brought that up, because he's actually addressed it recently. A good manager probably should be able to adapt to different situations, but it would seem he's got no intention of doing that at all. He spoke to BBC Radio Leeds the other day and he said the style, the model has already shown it can work and be imposed. And I believe that deviating from the plan will only make the situation worse. What do you make of that?
He's a Moneyball guy. You know. I love it. And I love, he's a proper Moneyball guy, man. He's Billy Bean levels Moneyball guy. He's obviously just said like, look, this works. This system definitely 100% works. I'm going to stick to it no matter what. And he had the same problems when he was coaching over in France. Like they were just getting annihilated every time, probably because from the same situations. Like they had an injury table the size of God knows what. And they just couldn't cope with the level of intensity that he was expecting from the players.
But you know, in the latter years of Arsene Wenger's reign, he was guilty of this, like sticking to his philosophy, passing you out of situations, staying composed on the ball. When the fact is, the players he was using to try and implement that style, they weren't of the quality that he had in recent years. And that led to some pretty fucking heavy defeats, man, against the top teams, you know, like embarrassing defeats for a club of Arsenal's stature. I completely admire Bielsa for standing in front of the fire and being like, yeah, fuck you. Like, I know what I'm doing. I'll go down with the ship if I have to, not bothered. On the other hand, I think it's a sign of strength to adapt to the situation. But you can get that wrong too. Look what Pep was doing in the Champions League final. You know, didn't play Fernandinho. He thought himself out of the game. So there's danger to that side as well. But as a general rule, I would absolutely say if you've got dire injury problems, you might have to adapt to that situation. Whatever those adaptations are, I couldn't say. Obviously, not a football manager. But
do you think it fair to... I like the idea he's got this solid philosophy and wants to stick to it. It works in games like poker and things like that. You always play the best odds and it work out over the long run. But I don't think it works in like a living, breathing game like football. Do you think it'd be fair to say that it looks like he doesn't have a plan B? And do you think it might be more prudent for a manager in his position to have a plan B? Like, I'm going to stick to this philosophy, but if shit hits the fan, I've got this setup to use. Do you think that'd be a fair statement? Or
I think great managers really should have a plan B. Do you know what I mean? And they should be able to think outside of the box and adapt. I think that would be the difference between a great manager and perhaps somebody that just comes in and does good jobs in certain situations, which has happened with Bielsa. He got it right at Leeds when they were playing at a much lower level in the Championship. And that style, that system really worked with those players. But don't forget, playing that way, the high press style is predicated on your players' fitness levels and also their mental fitness levels as well. Being able to anticipate, being able to stay focused. And that's something that's very, very difficult to measure. And at the moment, sports don't do a good enough job of acquiring how to manage and how to acquire that knowledge about a player's mental attributes. And I think that's something that I've been looking into a lot recently. It's the sort of mental side of the game and how you sort of quantify it and how you get players in that are going to best fit that model. Because a lot of what he does and what he expects is down to like mental toughness and mental, how can I say, focus, really. Do you know what I mean? It's, especially with the pressing cues and stuff like that, that he expects of the players. It's very, very difficult. But is it also a case of pragmatism not being very sexy when it comes to football? Do you know what I mean? Because... Sean Dyche, man, he's been there for how long? Has he been there now? Eight years. For a tenure of that, of that longevity in the Premier League is remarkable, really. And every year their expectations are to barely stay in the Premier League, and their board are quite happy for him to do that. And you know, there's not always high pressure. When they start, you know, when they're in the bottom three, nobody's panicking. The fans aren't panicking. The players aren't panicking. And then, bam, they start getting results like 3-0 away at Brighton. And then they manage to stay up. Every single year they've done it for the last how long?
What's in it for them, like financially?
Staying in the Premier League? Huge. Yeah. TV revenues alone are enough to warrant just staying in the Premier League and not competing. Because I think... Burnley have found like a niche, really, in terms of their marketability and, you know, balancing the sort of fans' happiness and their sort of existence in the sort of footballing sphere with making money. I think they're in a nice little, you know, like sort of area where they can just about compete every year to stay in the Premier League. They get the make sure they get the TV revenues in. They're making sure they're keeping, a good level of players, and they're not overspending. Whereas some teams like Fulham have done it historically. The last few times they've been in Premier League, spend a lot of money, get relegated, drop down. They got all these players on high wages. Luckily, the last couple of times they've managed to bounce straight back up, and obviously they're dominating the Championship at the moment. But sooner or later, what happens is when teams do that is, for whatever reason, the team dynamics in the dressing room don't quite work out. You've got these players on 35, 40 grand a week that don't want to be there, so they're not putting in the performances. And then there's a real sort of like imbalance in the quality of players. You might have really good players and some players that are sort of like League One, Championship level, but you're trying to balance the books. So some you're trying to get off on loan. Some, you know, you're trying to get off the books, but they just stay in there. They want to see out their three-year contract. So that's where it becomes a problem. Do you know what I mean? So there is a lot of value in just being able to exist in the Premier League.
It goes back to what you were mentioning about players' mental health. I think that that situation seems to benefit the guys who own the team. It, the fans get a bit of excitement at the end of every league. But the only thing, the only detractor that I see is players wanting to have better careers, getting sick of that situation. So what do you make of that?
I don't know. Players like Ben Mee and James Tarkowski, they probably fucking live for it, man. They live for relegation scraps. You know what I mean? That's the sort of players he's got. And Sean Dyche, he's that sort of manager, man. He probably loves it. He probably does love the nitty and gritty and, like, you know, at the end of the season, having something to play for. So, I mean, I'm not going to say that players and managers love being in a relegation battle, but I'm saying they're certainly built, like, mentally now, they're built for it. So you come against teams that have just been promoted and they're in a relegation battle, like Brentford, for example. You come the end of the season, man, we'll see in the last six games who gets more points, Burnley or Brentford. I would put my house on Burnley getting more than Brentford.
Yeah, because it's like an inverse title challenge, isn't it? It's something to play for. If you're kind of knocking around 10th, 11th, you're not going to Europe, you know. And I think Sean Dyche is the kind of guy who'd be like, yeah, we're fucking well up for this now. Let's absolutely show him how to do this. And I think Burnley fans are just happy to get a win when they can. Like, their eyes aren't too big for their belly. I think teams like Everton, like, that's their problem at the minute. We've circled around it. They've got so much history, so much, like, supposed lineage, do you know what I mean? So much quality. But let's be honest. They were, like, what, top four under David Moyes for a few seasons about 15 years ago, and that's about that. Where's this quality? Where is this expectation coming from? What, because you're in the same city as another team that are, like, much better? I'm not trying to denigrate Everton fans. I'm just saying, like, where does the expectation come from? But if you're a team like Burnley, if you've got hopes of, you know, going into Europe and that, they've even made Europe, but that's, like, a bit of an anomaly. But to have these hopes and dreams, it can be to your detriment in the long term, especially financially. It's a precarious game, man, for sure.
Yeah, and I think the more monopolization we see in the Premier League, the more we see of these teams that expect and fans that expect. Like, West Ham have been a big one historically. Like, they've always expected more than their team's been able to realistically deliver. So when you get sort of 7-8 teams in that bracket, obviously you're going to have the Man City, Liverpool, Man United, Chelsea, to an extent Arsenal and Tottenham. They're always going to be top 10 for the majority, aren't they? Like, 95% of the time, they're all going to be in the top 10 for the next, say, 10 years. So they're the teams that are always going to be competing. And then if you've got another bracket of 8 teams that expect to be pushing for Europe and expect to be top table finishes, there's just not enough positions in the table to place these teams. So I think expectation can be a killer. And I think Burnley are in a really, really good situation at the minute. And I think they probably will stay up come the end of the season. It'd be surprising if they do go down. I think Norwich, Brentford and possibly Watford, they could be the three that go down. But the last gambit we're going to talk about on the football is going to be about Romelu Lukaku, a player that we've kind of focused on a lot on this podcast. And really, is he the best litmus test for the golfing quality between the Premier League and the rest of Europe? What do you reckon, Jim?
Well, I wanted to have a look at his career stats and just see if that bears out. Started off at Anderlecht, went to Chelsea. It was loaned out to West Brom and Everton before making a permanent move to Everton. So let's just look at his stats. I want to examine him from Chelsea, the loan move to West Brom, Everton, then Everton, because that's a good run of games in the Premier League. Starts off with 166 appearances, 87 goals. That is no mean feat. You know what I mean? And to be honest with you, he was highly rated at that time, highly rated enough to warrant a move to Manchester United. And there was a lot of hype around that move. 96 appearances, 42 goals, commensurate with his earlier efforts. Would you say that's fair? And then his move to Inter Milan, again, 95 appearances, 64 goals. He is basically a 1-in-2 striker wherever he goes. He's under a lot of flack at the minute, especially following that game. Was it last week when he only had like 7 touches of the ball? People were coming down hard on him. But I don't think, you know, let's say he has a poor season this season. I don't think that's indicative of any serious dip in form on his part. And I think he was able to produce the same performances at Inter that he has done in the Premier League, be that for West Brom, Everton, or Chelsea, or United. So it's actually mad how many teams he's gone to. He's still a young guy. He's like 28 or something. So he's like a bit of a modern day Nicolas Anelka. Saying that, Inter Milan the other night, I thought if he was playing for them, he would have put that game to bed against Liverpool. So, you know, I think he's a better player at Inter, especially this season. I don't think, it's hard to say. I think the Premier League's a more competitive league. It's a better league overall than in Italy. But are his performances, are his stats the exact, like a real good example of that? I'm not quite so sure, man.
I think he does come in for quite a lot of unwarranted criticism as well. Obviously, his return to the Premier League spoke of his successes at Inter Milan in these two seasons there. And we spoke about perhaps whether he'd acquired the additional experience and skills and perhaps change in his diet. And we spoke about, you know, he'd sort of like slimmed down a little bit perhaps. And, you know, would he be better fitted to the Premier League coming back after those 2 years at Inter? Because there's always been a massive question mark regarding his first touch. And this has been something that's followed him, you know, ever since he's sort of like big money signing at Man United. And obviously you mentioned that seven touches, which broke the record for the fewest touches in a Premier League game with just seven since the date has been recorded in 2003-2004. And he also has got a sort of unwanted statistic of he has lost possession as a result of an unsuccessful touch 29 times. Then he has a shot on target, a shot on goal with 28 in the Premier League this season. So I do feel like there's sort of a, like a lot of headhunters out there for Lukaku. I think perhaps his performances at Chelsea this season maybe haven't been as poor as sort of like people make out, but is 5 goals in 17 games really, is that good enough so far for Chelsea this season? Obviously, we don't want to, you know, you know, cut your season too short because he's got still a lot of football left to play this year. But would you say that's up to standard of what Chelsea are expecting from him?
Well, maybe not what Chelsea are expecting. I'd say it's more concerning for him as a player. You can see how consistent he's been over a long period, playing for a lot of different teams. So it might have been that he was due a little bit of a dip in form. Also, you hear it said a lot that the system he's playing in doesn't necessarily accentuate his strengths. I think that's a factor. But I think, as you say, I would be surprised if his numbers don't level out to somewhere near 1-2 by the end of the season. 13 games in the Premier League, Champions League to play. I don't know what cups they're still in. That's a lot of football, man. And I wouldn't be surprised if he grabs a brace here or there, maybe a hat-trick. He's a big, strong lad who can definitely cause problems in the opposition box when he's got the bit between his teeth. So I think it'll be foolhardy to rule him out or even trying to denigrate him, try and criticise him too harshly, even at this late stage in the season.
I'd just like to go back to the original question there, Bistit. Is Lukaku the best litmus test for the gulfing quality between the Premier League and the rest of Europe? Now, I think there probably is a gulfing quality between the English Premier League and the rest of Europe, but I don't know if he's the best evidence for that. Because what I'm seeing is 1 year in the top flight in Italy against 10 years in the top flight in England. So I don't know if he's the best. I don't know if we have enough data from his career alone to make that comparison, even though I do agree with the statement. But I just wanted to also point out that Fabio Capello has given his reasons why he thinks Lukaku's not performing at Chelsea. Did either of you guys hear about this? He was speaking to Sky Sport Italia, and he said Lukaku fit perfectly into Conte's counter-attacking style at Inter because there were lots of spaces. He had this physical strength and a pace that allowed him to flatten the defenders in Serie A. However, Chelsea play this very different type of football with lots of short passes, and Lukaku doesn't have the same space to move in. He also finds that in England, the defenders have a similar physicality to him and hold out more. What do you reckon to that? Do you agree with him there?
That's interesting. That is the physicality. Look, I think a lot of us, if we stood next to a lot of modern day footballers, they're fucking big lads, man. Do you know what I mean? So I think that might be a factor. But the Italians have always been lauded for their defensive organisation, their tactics. Maybe if they're not as physically intimidating, maybe they have the organisational advantage over a big, strong lad. It's an interesting point.
So I'll just put the microscope over his last four seasons as a football player. So he had 2 years at Inter Milan. So he had 2 years, 36 games in each year. One, he scored 23 goals. One, he scored 24 goals. Both his biggest hauls as a player for a season. The year before he moved to Inter Milan, he got 12 goals in 32 appearances for United. And now the year after, he's managed 5 in 17. So obviously the percentages aren't quite up to scratch for what he did in Milan. And the reason that I brought up the litmus test idea of you know, in being able to show that difference in quality, because it's like sandwiched in between. Do you know what I mean? He's had one mediocre level season, you know, in terms of Man United forwards, based on, you know, the amount of chances that his teammates should be creating, even though he wasn't there in a sort of like classic Man United great team era. And then he's moved to a Chelsea team that are also expected to create a lot of chances for him as well. So I think that does sort of show the gulf in quality between the two leagues. And perhaps it might just come down to the fact that, yeah, Fabio Capello's got a point. You know, tactically, both of the leagues are very, very different. And he hasn't quite adjusted, or never has adjusted to life in the Premier League. But at West Brom, and I think at Everton, he had very, very successful seasons as well. I just don't know why it hasn't quite worked out for him yet at Chelsea.
Could we bring this back to an earlier point about, is it up to players or managers? Could this be a management issue? Is he not being used properly?
I think it is for him, you know. I think, you know, it's undoubted the quality of player he is. And I think he's the type of guy where you have to build your system around him to make it work. Whereas at Chelsea, they've got so many sick players. But like Kante, he basically runs shit in that team. You know what I mean? Alonso down the left-hand side, a lot of chances, a lot of creative opportunities go through him. Your man Ziyech, he's absolutely smashing it. He gets a lot of the ball. Pulisic, you know, he's an outlet for him as well. I think if you've got those kind of players in your squad, it would be a waste to not make the best use of them. And it just turns out that Lukaku may have suffered as a result, because everything's not going through him. He's not the focal point of that team. And maybe that's something that he can address himself. Maybe he's not willing to be just a cog in the machine. Maybe it's an attitude problem. Maybe he's not completely embracing the process. I wish I was in the dressing room. I would love to see like how these things play out, because he can't be happy with the way things are going. And if I was his manager, if I was Tommy Tuchel, I wouldn't be happy with the way he's playing either. So something's got to give there. And then there was that comment, like, Chelsea were like my fourth choice team, whatever, that he later retracted and apologised for. It's not plain sailing in that dressing room at the minute. I wouldn't be surprised if he leaves in the summer.
And Tuchel obviously isn't happy with his performances, as he did leave him out for that Champions League clash against Lille. Obviously then winning 2-0. Ziyech starting. I think he's become one of them more integral players in that team over the past few weeks. Pulisic got a start. He scored. Kai Havertz started as the sort of focal point, as a striker. He started in the Lukaku position. And he's a very, very different player to Lukaku.
He's been killing it, man. Havertz has. He's been smashing it.
Yeah, and obviously scored in the Champions League final against Man City when they won. You know, and I think he's an integral part of that team as well. But he plays in a completely different style. He's almost like a false nine, whereas Lukaku's like more of a classic target man. He wants the ball to feet. He wants to pin the player down, you know, perhaps play a 1-2, maybe roll the defender, look to get shots on target. So he really does play a completely different style to Chelsea, to Havertz. And I think that kind of works for them as well. Having that sort of different dynamic for two strikes, things is always an advantage for a team. Because, you can shuffle your deck and, you know, it makes you quite unpredictable in terms of setting up your tactics for the opposition. And obviously, they had a good result against Lille. Elsewhere in the Champions League, Villarreal and Juventus drew. Old Sebastian Haller, who's been a revelation for Ajax since moving there from West Ham. We spoke about him a few times. He's put a ball in each net. You know what I mean? He can score in whichever hole he wants, can't he?
Killing it. Absolutely kill it. He's He's so industrious as a goal scorer. He just doesn't give a fuck where he puts it, man.
And obviously United, they had a poor, really, really poor first half. I think they didn't manage one single touch in the opposition penalty area in the first half, but they ended up coming out with a 1-1 draw. Anthony Elanga scoring again. Another player that's really sort of, you know, kicked on in the last sort of like month or so. He's getting a lot more opportunities, obviously, with the problems that's happening at United, obviously, with Mason Greenwood. And you know, Jesse Lingard, he's been a bit of a bit part player as well, hasn't he? So he's getting a lot more opportunities. So fair play to him. What did you make of Diego Simeone saying they were facing one of the best teams in the world?
What, in United?
Yeah.
That's interesting, man, because I thought Atletico were going to slap the shit out of United, really. And, you know, that first goal, it looked like it was going to be heavy weather all night, but they obviously they've regrouped. It wasn't, from the highlights, it didn't look like it was the most enthralling game. But going back to Elanga, I mean, the passage of play, the short one-touch passage from United that released Fernandes to drive into the midfield, then release Elanga, who dropped a beautiful little dummy to get himself clear and, you know, started the ball home very neatly indeed. That is what you want if you're a United fan, if you're the manager, if you're anything to do, because that is like, what do they call it? Is it clutch moment?
Yeah, clutch. Yeah, in the moment. One chance taking it.
Yeah, clutch. That was what it was. And what was the general vibe over Twitter? Like, were people saying this is like underperformance from Atletico? Was this United scraping another draw? Obviously, away goals are done with. Otherwise, this would have been a much more significant result. Like, how was this result received generally?
I think initially it was sort of like, oh, you know, the United that we've come to know over the last few years, like, you know, underperforming yet again. Like, Atletico Madrid is, you know, historically they've been really good in the Champions League. I think they've won the La Liga a couple of times over the last 5 years, haven't they? They've got to a lot of finals of the Champions League, at least two against Real Madrid. So
they've won the Champions League as well, didn't they?
Yeah, they won it, didn't they? Yeah, I thought they did. And so they've become, you know, a real sort of mainstay in Champions League football. So I think to go back to Old Trafford, I think they'll fancy themselves. Do you know what I mean? Obviously, the away goals would have been perfect if they could have had that as well. That's been sacked off. But I still think that they'll fancy their chances at home to Atletico in the second leg. And I think they will qualify for the quarterfinal.
That João Félix is some player, any man. I wouldn't mind seeing him in the Premier League at some point, but I can see him like just staying over there for a bit. Maybe a controversial move to Madrid, Real Madrid. Imagine that.
I think they paid a hell of a lot of money for him as well, didn't they? As a like a 18-year-old, was it? João Félix, didn't they pay like 100 million for him or something?
From Lisbon? Was he from Sporting Lisbon?
Yeah. Another Portuguese player. They're players that sort of get overvalued a lot at the moment, aren't they, Portuguese players? But talking about Portuguese players, that player that plays for Wolves, Daniel Podence. What a player he is, man.
I think Ronaldo's spiked the premium on Portuguese players.
Yeah, they classic, paid 127 million they paid for him from Benfica as a
Benfica
18-year-old, I think he was at the time, or 20-year-old.
That's nuts. Mad money. I don't, you know what? For all the big money signings you hear about, that one rarely crosses my radar, to be honest. 120, is that Euros? Yeah, still fucking loads of money in it.
But he's got 17 goals and 3 assists in the league this season. So that's not bad so far this year, is it? What's that, like 17 goals in how many appearances? No, sorry, 17 appearances, 3 goals, 3 assists. So actually, no, not very good. That was his appearances. Boo. I was reading.
Shit ass.
Yeah, fuck that guy.
13% goal participation. He's not quite coming through then, is he? With the goals and assists. But we'll move on. We'll move on to the 5 things you might have missed. There's a couple of quite weird ones in it this week. Quirky ones. Number one, especially. Finnish athlete Remy Lindholm has said to he had to use a heat pack to try and thaw out his frozen penis after completing his 50-kilometer cross country in Beijing at the Winter Olympics this week or last week. By some miracle, the poor guy actually completed the race and admitted it's the second time that this particular incident has occurred. I don't know about you lads, but I would be calling it a day if I was him.
He was also quoted as saying, When the body part started to warm up after the finish, the pain was unbearable. And I fucking bet it was, man.
Mate, imagine pins and needles in your cock and balls. Imagine that.
Didn't you always used to say, Jim, the best feeling in the world is when brain freeze goes away? Can you imagine that feeling?
As if you remember that shit, fuck you. You got a long memory.
I remember every time I get brain freeze and it goes away.
Oh, it's such a great feeling, isn't it?
It's amazing. And imagine it down there.
Yeah, probably best to knock it on the head, not on your own, because it, you know, might crash to pieces like a fucking falling glacier. Like, I can't believe it.
And number two, the horse that won the 147th Kentucky Derby has been disqualified after the horse had a positive drugs test in the aftermath of the first leg of the Triple Crown last year. The news comes more than 2 months after the horse named Medina Spirit collapsed and died following a workout at Santa Anita. His trainer, Bob Baffert, has also been suspended for 90 days and was issued a $7,500 fine, which I'm sure will really, really teach him.
It also looks like the trainer, Bob Baffert, has a history of this. So back in 2018, another horse trained by him became just the second ever Triple Crown winner in four decades. The Triple Crown is awarded to horses that win three of the sport's most prominent races, the Kentucky Derby, the Preakness Stakes and the Belmont Stakes. Now, according to a report by the New York Times, the horse in question that was called Justify had failed a drug test weeks before its first Triple Crown race, which, had it been disclosed, would have disqualified it from participating in the race. And this guy's been at it for a while and he's denying everything, but I don't know.
Mate, should peds be a fucking issue for horses? Come on. What are we doing?
It looks like it is. Yeah. The drug in question, I forget the name, but it's something that can legitimately be used to treat inflammation in horses, but I think it also allows them, like steroids, to recover quicker from giant training.
But are we going to pretend that this is not a case of a beast with a midget on its back whipping it and making it jump over hedges? Are we saying, oh, this is a fucking hell? Don't insult the integrity of this sport. Horse racing is mental. I can see your face. I can see he's absolutely fuming. He's going to smash his coffee machine.
First of all, there's no hedges, man. There's no fences. This is a flat race.
Sorry, mate. Sorry.
But now, is this kind of like, you know, in The Wire when they're dogfighting and your man just like gives the dog a little boost. He gives one of the dogs a little boost and then he goes and just like absolutely annihilates your dog. Like, it's not fair, is it? It's not fair competition, no matter whether you're talking about animals or human beings. Like, sport should be fair. And like,
oh, come on, Visit.
This guy's boosting up his horse. It's not fair on the other horses, is it?
Mate, what's fair competition? Come on, I genuinely don't think that exists. I don't think it exists. I mean, you could talk about fairness, but a level playing field, nah, man. That playing field is bumpy as fuck. Probably because horses are running all over it, man.
Do you want to hear a good quote from the whoever they are, the horse association people?
yeah.
They say, winning the Kentucky Derby is one of the most exciting achievements in sports, and we look forward to celebrating the real winner, Mandaloon, on a future date in a way that is fitting of this rare distinction.
Well, does that mean that he's going to win the Kentucky Derby in the future, or are they going to do a ceremony for him?
So the horse in question, the drugged up horse, is Medina Spirit.
Yeah,
they're giving it to the second place Mandaloon.
Yeah, but are they going to do like a little parade for him? It's going to be a bit of an anticlimax, isn't it?
Well, they're going to celebrate like
9 months
in a way
after the
fitting
race.
There's going to be fireworks. There's going to be Van Halen playing everything.
The equestrian committee
who's
for fairness and due diligence.
Yeah, who's going to go to that? I wonder who's going to turn up.
Andy Bissett, I think, for one.
let's email him. I reckon Bissett do it, man. You can wrap a wreath around the horse's neck, give it a slap on the arse.
We could do a live pod there.
Oh, mate, let's do it. Let's go Kentucky.
But anyway, I had £10 each way. I'm a Dinner Spirit, so I won about 165 quid. So that's all.
Oh,
that
lovely.
Really matters, isn't it?
So you still get the payout even though the drug allegations come.
Yeah, they're going to take the money back off you because apparently he was drugged up, isn't it? Like, it's like back in Lance Armstrong in the Tour de France and him winning. And then like 10 years later, they're like, you know what? I need that 20 quid back, please. I mean, he cheated. I need that money back. We're talking about fairness in sports. The US women's national team have reached a settlement agreement with US soccer regarding equal pay claims. The players will receive a lump sum payment of around $22 million after a years-long fight that spawned a 2019 lawsuit by players against the federation. This was around a third of what the players initially sought out, but it'll feel like a win for women's football. Megan Rapinoe, who has perhaps been one of the most vocal during the fight for equal pay, said, "Justice comes in the next generation. I do, however, feel that there is a lot of work left to do, as a lump sum will need to be distributed in a manner proposed by the players and approved by the district court. So good luck sorting that out anytime soon."
Do they feel that... basically, I was just trying to get the long way around to... That's a very generous use of the word justice. I think that... Look, we've said it before, and I'll battle my inclinations to be sarcastic about this. But I honestly think that women get paid less money overall in sports because for myriad reasons, their sports generate less money and that's their contracts reflect that. I'm not saying there's not a gender disparity there at all. But I also think that this court case, as you say, what is it, $22 million to spread across the league? That seems like an empty gesture to me. That's not really actual change. That being said, I think Megan Rapinoe's got a point in that this will set a precedent to build upon in future years. In principle, it's a good thing. In reality, how much does this change the landscape for women's football? I hope that players can go and play their sport professionally and feel valued and feel like they're competing on a level footing with men. That's important, you know, for your own fucking dignity and self-respect and all that kind of stuff. But how much does this, for the moment, affect things? I'm not sure the whole lot, really.
And what has it achieved, really? Because, all right, the women's players in question that have made appearances for the US women's national team, I'm not sure how far historically they're going to go back. So are they going back to, what, 2015, 2016? Because they've been successful for 20 years. So does that mean, you know, like Abby Wambach and Carly Lloyd, are they going to get a big percentage of this money? And like, you know, if a player's played one appearance, are they only going to get $20? Like, so how are they going to divide up the payments? Is Megan Rapinoe going to get 50% of this $22 million because she's the one that like was the at the forefront of all this controversy, but the protests and stuff?
I'd say she'd get a fair whack, but again, she might forego her piece of the pie entirely. She's one of the forerunners, one of the faces of women's football internationally. I can't imagine that she's hurting for money, but I imagine there are quite a few professional female players who, similar to the situation in the UFC, living paycheck to paycheck, just basically making a normal wage, but playing a sport. So it's not fair on that level. They should get paid more if that's the case. But again, it really is a reflection of the popularity of their sport. Players in the Premier League, in Serie A, in Ligue 1, in La Liga, they get mega money because they're like the TV rights, the sponsorships, all the commercial endorsements. It's fucking massive. Billions of people watch it.
It's a simple equation, isn't it? It's a simple equation. More people watch it, more eyes on screens, more subscriptions equals more money to pay the athletes. That's kind of just how it works. All right, UFC is slightly different. There is a lot of eyes on screens, a lot of subscription sales. Perhaps that model works very, very differently to football, which I imagine it does. I'm not privy to the exact information of how each of the systems work, but you know, I do think that women's football, it's light years away from men's, isn't it, in terms of like consumerism and viewability. It's just nowhere near at the minute. So you know, I'm surprised that they've managed to get that much. Really, I think they wanted $66 million. They got a third of it, but
you could make the argument that if women's football was given the same promotion and attention that men's football has received, maybe it would be as popular. You could make that argument. I don't know if that's true, but you know, that's what I'd be thinking if I was on the other side of the fence. I'm not even on any side of the fence. I'm just saying that it's without question that men's football has received the emphasis since it's been going on, and women's football is in relative infancy.
Really good points, both sides. Yeah, it doesn't bring in as much money, nowhere near as much money as the men's football, but has it been promoted in the same way? I think it's clear that it hasn't. What I want to know is this 22 million, how many players is this being split between?
That's what he was on about. How does it work? Is it, you know, anybody that's made an appearance for the US women's national team gets a certain percentage of it? So they've basically, they've left it down to them to sort out. And I think it's going to take longer than the actual court case has took to being resolved, to actually resolved where the money goes and how they divvy it up. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, how easily that comes across, because I don't think that's going to be easy at all. But sticking with female, sticking with women's football, Michaela Moore of the New Zealand national women's football team had a disastrous time, to say the least, against USA women on Sunday. She scored a hat-trick of her own goals and was then subbed in the 40th minute, probably to her immense relief, and US women went on to win 5-0. I would assume that this has never happened at the professional level. I can't remember it happening. I can't even remember, I think, 2 own goals in one game. I mean, it's quite rare to see 3 own goals being scored in a whole season, let alone in 35 minutes. So, and the goals were, yeah, they were, it was tough to watch. Tough to watch. I felt really bad for her, to be fair.
Thoughts and prayers to Michaela Moore. I can vaguely recall a player scoring 2 own goals, but you're right, it's an absolute rarity.
You know, I think I might know who it is, you know.
Go on.
Is it Michael Dubry that used to play for Leeds? I think he might have scored 2 goals in a game once. Two own goals. Yeah.
I'm pretty certain it's happened in the Premier League. Go on, Bissett. He's going for it, man. And it's not as if New Zealand, or it's not as if the USA needed a leg up against New Zealand, as you've said. I know they experienced recent problems against Canada, not even a real country anyway. But yeah, they got smacked up, didn't they? So they're on the outward path, but they're still a dominant force in women's football. So New Zealand probably could have done without the hat trick of own goals in the first half.
What do you make of this nonsense of the She Believes Cup?
Oh, what's that?
No, this is what they played in, this She Believes Cup. And every year, it's ran by the US, I believe. And it's like an invitational tournament. And it's kind of like the US just invite different countries, whoever they want. Oh, who's not doing very well this year? Oh, like Iceland aren't a very good team. Yeah, let's put them in. Let's give them let's beat them 5-0. Oh, New Zealand. All right. Yeah. They've only had a team for 2 years. Let's bring them in. Michaela Moore. Oh, she plays semi-pro. Like, you know what I mean? She's a baker by trade. Let's bring them in. Let's beat them 5-0. You know what I mean? Like, what is that all about? Like, play good teams. Set up a tournament where you're playing France, where you're playing Spain, where you're playing Canada. Teams that can beat you. What is the point in playing teams that you're just going to demolish every time? And that this is, you know, what really pisses me off about the women's national team.
But you know, because there isn't the same breadth and depth that there is in the men's game. But listen, fucking how many times have we disparaged the whole European World Cup qualifying process because they're just whipping teams that don't belong on the same pitch as them? This is endemic in the men's game as well. Now, maybe because the She Believes Cup is like a one-off thing that isn't associated with a bigger tournament, maybe it's open to criticism on that level, but this is rampant in football, you know. Like, it really is. Like, how many like San Marino, Luxembourg, fucking North Macedonia, Albania, these type of teams, they're going to get smacked up, aren't they? Like, it's going to happen. Is it worse because the USA invites them and trying to, is that what you're getting at?
Way worse, yeah. Because at least, like, with the European qualifiers, like, it's been set up by, you know, an external, like, governing body of the sport. You know, so it's kind of like, all right, yeah. And they've been picked out of a pot. All right, San Marino in England's group again. They're going to get smashed 12-0. But like, US are like going out there hand-picking teams. Or I guess that's how they choose. But yeah, I just think it's a bit ridiculous, really, that they're even playing this. Do you know what I mean? But I suppose they need something to do, don't they, in between World Cups?
Just make it my trade.
I just want to go back to the most own goals scored in a game ever. I've just found this on Quora, a comment from someone. I've just looked it up and it looks like it was real. The record for most own goals scored in a single match dates back to 2002 in a match that also set the record for the most goals ever scored in a single senior game. In Madagascar's Stade Olympique Lemouna, they scored in their own net. How many times do you reckon? quick quiz question. Whoever's closest gets it.
It's going to be there's a protest, isn't it? 17.
It was a protest. 8 and 17. It's Bissett got it. It's 149 times. and the final score was 149-0. And it was in protest of a refereeing decision that had gone against them.
Oh, so it was probably 2-0 after 5 minutes. The Geezer was 3 yards offside. And then the third goal, they just went, you know what, fuck this. We're just going to score now, isn't it?
Rangers should have done that the other night against Dortmund. Did you see that VAR call? That was a fucking disgrace.
You know what, though? I'm unsure about that. We'll have to get Flynn on that and research it and have a look at the FA rules handbook to see. Because I know which one you're talking about. You're talking about where Morales has got in front of the player as I think it's Emre Can. As he's about to play a pass, he's got in front of his passing leg and tripped him up. I think that's a foul.
Sacrilege from Andy Bissett, man. Baker by trade.
Baker by trade.
Well, I'll tell you what, because we're running long on this, we'll get back to that another time, but I completely disagree.
Yeah. And finally, Mike Tyson has obviously been on Twitter again following a session on the Devil's Cabbage. He tweeted, "Life is just a beautiful process of dying. As soon as you are born, the process begins," like Benjamin Button. Can't disagree with him, really.
Yeah, Mike's been licking frogs again, hasn't he? Fair play to him. It's hard to imagine that the kid, the muscled up kid with a 20-inch neck, who used to absolutely savour breaking ribs and fucking causing concussions, is now on some absolute Buddhist vibe, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? It's difficult to comprehend, but hardcore drugs will change your personality. That is simple as that, isn't it? So, especially if you've gone from weed to alcohol to cocaine, back to weed, then onto mushrooms.
So, psychedelics, going to mellow anyone out.
He's on the mushrooms all the time now, isn't he?
Oh, Hatred. He just sits sometimes on his podcast. I don't listen to it or watch it all the time, but sometimes he just looks like he's actually growing roots into the ground. He does not move.
Did you see when they had Habib on it? He was too stoned to even ask a question. He had to get, was it Henry Cejudo to ask all the questions?
Yeah. I think Khabib was just looking at him I think at one point he's like, "You want to punch me, don't you?" And Mike was like, "Nah, man."
Yeah. He said he thought Ali was the best boxer ever. "Do you want to punch me?" Habib even said afterwards, he said, "I lost a bit of respect for him after that." He didn't come across like an athlete, like an ex-athlete after that.
Yeah, but
I mean, he's won the game. He can do what he wants. After.
Yeah, isn't it?
Khabib's hardcore, though, isn't he? Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He's got a different perspective, and he's entitled to it. He's gonna smash you, the boy, guys.
Alhamdulillah.
They don't like this, Joe. They don't like this. I'm gonna smash you, boy. Absolutely sick, man.
And he won't be sucking the secretions of the Mexican staring frog.
The hypnotoad.
Which leads us nicely onto this week's featured fights.
Segue.
We'll start with the retrospective and topping a woeful card that seemed to take up all of last Saturday night. I was very disappointed by that undercard. Kell Brook and Amir Khan brought an end to their rivalry that stretched back to their amateur days, probably the better part of 20 years. And there's no other way to say it. Brook beat the living fuck out of him. I knew Khan was in trouble by the way Brook eased out of the way of his first combination. And this was at an early point in the fight where Khan's speed should have been at its most potent. But Brook moved like he knew what was coming. And he only solidified his position from there. I felt like he rattled Khan with the first clean shot he landed. And he found particular success with the right hand all night. The way he disguised it behind his jab bewildered Khan, who could... It was as if he either couldn't see it or couldn't get out of the way. And either way, he was just taking him clean on the chin. But I'll say this for Khan. He must have been in decent shape because he absorbed punches throughout the 6 rounds of this fight that would have dropped him in the past easily. His training camp must have been on point. He must have had an extra dose of prideful stubbornness keeping him up as well. None of it was enough. As early as the second round, Brook just began walking him down with little to no regard for what was coming back. And that's how it played out until the stoppage. Brook was stalking and punishing, Khan retreating and doing anything he could to stay upright. I'm sad to say this, but it was a bad mismatch in the end. but I was very impressed with both men post-fight and how they conducted themselves. A lot of mutual respect. Khan was particularly humble in defeat. That couldn't have been easy, man, because there was a lot riding on this in terms of bragging rights, etc. I think both fighters should actually retire now. I think Khan, there's no doubt he's finished. Brock, I think, while I believe he'd be competitive for another year or two at the top level, I think it's heavy weather if he chooses to circulate amongst the fighters up there. I like the Keith Thurman fight. I like the Ugas fight. I still think he'd beat the European champion, David Avanesian. Conor Benn, Chris Eubank Jr., these are all real financially viable possibilities. There's millions to be made, and I could see him stepping into the ring again. But I just think this win over Khan would be the perfect way to sign off on his career. So what do you guys think? Did you guys watch the fight?
I just caught the highlights, but I wanted to get your take on the glove situation. Was it the first round? What was the story there?
Bro, I was fucking disgusted by that, you know. Basically, the contract stipulated on Khan's side that none of the gloves could contain horse hair, which is a substance for the padding of the gloves. And that's basically favoured by big punchers. So Amir Khan's got a little stipulation into the contract whereby he was trying to lessen the potential power of Kell Brook. Now, horse hair is present in a large majority of boxing gloves to various percentages. So it went down to the wire where he's changing his gloves in the ring. I thought that was wholly unprofessional. I don't know how the board allowed it to get to that point. You're supposed to, when the fighters choose their gloves, it's like 3 days before the fight. They're supposed to be observed for the next 3 days. There's like a chain of custody that goes with the gloves. This is for safety reasons. You don't know if people are manipulating those gloves, taking the padding out. Listen, that's happened in the past. It's changed people's lives, ruined careers, smashed people's faces in. You know, the game's dangerous enough without you tampering with the gloves. I was shocked when I seen him doing that in the middle of the ring. And I think there should have been a bigger deal made of it. The British Boxing Board of Control, I don't know if they did release a press cut, say a statement addressing it, but this should have been front and center of the fight. How is that happening? It's 2022. It's not 1956. Do you know what I mean? I thought it was disgusting, to be honest.
I think it really exacerbates the kind of Wild West like thing that they've got going on with the British border control, boxing border control. Like, really, that's something that feels like something that should be standard measures. Do you know what I mean? When it comes to a governing body, like, as you just pointed out, they should be checking the gloves. Like, I think in all sports, for example, like where there's equipment, like table tennis, even the bats are checked. Do you know what I mean? They're checked just prior to prior to the competitors going out on to perform. They will have to leave their bats with an umpire, or, you know, they'll have a specific person checking the bat to make sure it's by the measurements and the standard procedures that's expected by the organizing body. So it's just unbelievable that these things keep on cropping up with boxing in regards to drugs, in regards to, you know, equipment, and in regards to lead up to the fight. And then you've got the whole issues with, you know, the promotional side of it as well. As you say, it just feels like the Wild West with boxing at the minute. And it's, you know, it hasn't changed, has it, really?
Well, it's not to say that those secondary pair of gloves weren't under observation as well. But if you're Amir Khan, you don't know where those gloves have come from. They could have just been like sitting in the boot of someone's car. Do you know what I mean? There's so many moving parts to that. You have to minimize the potential for foul play. That is your responsibility as a governing body. And I didn't think that they did that in that instance. Now, bear in mind, I shared something in the group the other day. This did like the biggest numbers outside, according to the promoter, which is going to say that. We'll take that with a grain of salt. But it was a highly successful pay-per-view. And there's a lot of money. Like, people are paying for this. They're making career high paydays, basically. There's no excuse for this. There's no excuse for this on a small hall show. Never mind on the biggest stage. And I was just... It's expecting too much to want the British Boxing Board of Control, the promoter, the fighters, managers and all that to come out and say they fucked up. But I honestly think that's what happened. So I hope we get none of that this week with Josh Taylor and Jack Catterall. And with this look ahead, I want to start by giving a shout out to my dad, Jimmy Hutton, because he's been hassling me for the past few weeks. So He listens to the show multiple times a week. He always encourages me and he tells me to include things that I never end up including. But I'm bringing him up for a reason. I told him to watch the Gloves Are Off episode for Josh Taylor and Jack Catterall tomorrow night, which I found fascinating, of course. He messaged me back saying it was long and boring with a yawn emoji. And I thought long and boring. This is 23 minutes of intense preamble to a fight for the undisputed light welterweight championship of the world. The man's on another fucking planet as far as I'm concerned. But to be fair, India's probably on that same planet as well. She yawns her way through hours and hours of boxing most weekends, man.
I've got a problem with the gloves off though. It really winds me up the way they sit on the chairs, man. I just like every time I see it, I'm just like, it just winds me up, man.
The way they lean on the back of the chair.
Yeah. Just like, for fuck's sake, why are you doing that?
I don't like the way Johnny Horsecock Nelson tries to make them shake hands. Are we going to get a handshake? Are we going to get a handshake? Mate, Johnny, fucking leave it, man. Do you know what I mean? They obviously don't like each other. But I took a lot away from that. The preamble of the Gloves Are Off. Basically, the unflappable Jack Catterall, I feel like he's not one to welt under the hot lights of a high-level competition. Josh Taylor, his personality is such that he's in a very combative mode whenever he's around his opponents. And during that interview, he attempted a series of provocations on Catterall. He used anger, sarcasm, false praise, disparagement, all to get some kind of reaction. He even approached Catterall after the interview ended. He clapped the hand on his shoulder and told him he was never going to win, et cetera, et cetera. Catterall didn't bite once. He stared a hole through Taylor the whole time. Anything that might have provoked him, Catterall just shrugged and said, yeah, we'll see, won't we, on the night. It was quite unnerving, to be honest, this mask of complete determination and confidence. I thought this fight was going to be a walkover for Taylor, and it still might be. But now I'm intrigued to see if Catterall's composure holds, because if it does, that will likely lead to a more exciting and competitive fight. And up to this point now, final press conference, fight, the weigh-ins, they're all done, they're good to go. Catterall still hasn't cracked. I am looking forward to this. All that being said, I did watch the highlights of his most recent fight, and I think this kid's in trouble, man. Have you guys been paying any attention to the build-up to this one?
I've not called it myself, but just from your breakdown there, is it Catterall who kept the composure?
And yeah.
Stared daggers through him. Then my money's on him. He sounds like he's got it.
I think based on body language alone, if I didn't know anything about either fighter, I would go down the same lines, man. But the fact is his feet aren't quick enough. His hands are too low. And I think Josh Taylor, 19 professional fights, undisputed champion of the world, fought the highest level of competition from probably his 12th fight onwards. It's such a drab series of undercards that Sky have put forward in recent weeks under the Pro Bellum promotional banner. Eubank Jr. versus Williams, Khan versus Brook, both terrible undercards. Both in name value and general quality, Taylor and Catterall looks to be the same. A series of novices and debutantes against journeymen with unpronounceable names. Now, I'm not suggesting any of these supporting fighters are bad. I'm just saying, I watch more boxing than your average bear, and I don't know any of these fighters on the undercard. And if I'm not getting excited about it, your average sports fan has no chance. So that's an issue for them moving forward. Last one. Are we generally bothered about Islam Makhachev's next fight? Flynn, this...
I love him.
To both of you, really.
I love the Dagestani boys, even though it's probably going to be the same as the Dan Hooker fight, his last fight. He took the fight last minute after someone pulled out. He's probably just going to get him in a Kimura in 10 seconds and destroy him. But I'm hyped either way.
Yeah, I'm sure I saw a graphic the other day. I'm pretty sure it was Makhachev. Let me see if we can get up. It was saying that since 2020, he's had 5 cancelled fights, 3 withdrawals by opponent, one withdrawal by Makhachev himself, and 1 event cancellation. What is it with this guy? Is it just that people don't want to fight him? What are the issues? Where are they coming from?
I don't know, man. The kids, it seems like an unlucky run, to be honest. I think there might be a touch of lads being like, yeah, fuck that, like, can't be arsed. But you're always going to have people like Dan Hooker, who's still a high-quality opponent. A victory over him was enough to earn Michael Chandler a title shot in his second ever UFC go. It was enough to catapult Islam into title contention. Yeah, listen, there are always going to be hard cases, and born winners who are willing to take this fight. And I actually feel like Beneil Dariush, the initial slated opponent, would have been one of those guys. And that fight would have been Grapple Fest 3000. I would have loved it, but obviously Beneil Dariush suffered a broken fibula in preparations. He had to withdraw. Bobby Green has stepped in. And I remember saying this to you a few months ago. I seen Bobby Green on an undercard against Fizayev, I think. And I remember saying, this guy's sick, man. I'm surprised I've never seen him before. Like, he's slick, hands down, slip and rip kind of fighter. Proper entertaining. And he seems like a bit of a nutcase as well. So he's always good to listen to on the mic. I'd assume that Islam is going to just Khabib him. But still, anything can happen in the cage. And that's why we tune in, even when it's supposed to be a lopsided fight. So I'll still watch it. But I want to see Islam, like, basically title shot next. And with Conor McGregor supposedly coming back, skipping the queue because of his millions upon millions, then, yeah, I think Islam's going to be waiting a while yet.
And what's going to happen with the, you know, the smash your boy brigade of fighters? Like, in terms of obviously what's going on with the situation with Russia and Ukraine, and we spoke about a lot of the sporting events that had been moved, like the Champions League final been moved, the Euros been moved, the Eurovision Song Contest, which I'm sure you're going to be gutted about. but what happens with the fighters? Obviously, because Dagestan's a republic in Russia, isn't it? So do these fighters, will they fall under the same banner? And will, you know, the UFC potentially, will Dana White look to not let them fight until the conflict's been resolved or what?
I think if your top boys are Russian or from a Russian peninsula, a Russian province, I would fucking not even address the subject until journalists start posing the question to you, really. I'd say hold it down. I would say it would be more turbulent for Ukrainian fighters who are based out there. I think Russia, by and large, look how big Russia is. Like, there's going to be a lot of people completely unaffected by the hostilities between both countries at the minute. Yeah, if you're fathead Dana, you'd probably keep it on the low until... Well, the thing is, their press conferences are shit because they only let approved people in and they just softball questions, man. The UFC press conferences are like, they're not the best, to be honest, I don't think. Like, he's got it all closed down. Even like Ariel Helwani, you saw all that shit.
He says, love it.
Yeah, he says anything out of line and they just fucking basically bully him out of the rooms. It's not a real press conference. It's like, it's basically like a presidential fucking, you know what I mean? A presidential speech. You're approved and then you're coming in. If you're not, you can go to your podcast in the fucking car park.
Yeah, you know? There's like the select sort of people that are allowed to be there. And generally, they're kind of like a little bit pally-pally. There's no people, they're not inviting, like, you know, people there that are really looking to dress them down, do you know what I mean? And sort of like poke them and see what they can sort of like get them to like slip up on or anything. So
I think if anyone in the world of sports is going to get around sanctions and regulations, it's Dana White. in the middle of COVID, he was like, fuck it, Fight Island. I'll just make a Fight Island. No one could travel anywhere, but he managed it. He put on a sports event. He could do this.
Here's the thing, man. Like, I admire Dana White a lot, but there's also certain things that he does that I don't agree with. I think he's beyond reproach as a promoter, by and large. I mean, we spoke before about fighter pay, etc. We're not well informed enough to comment on what a fight is worth, what a fighter should be paid, pay-per-view points, all this kind of stuff. This is above our heads, if we're being honest about it. But he definitely creates that soft, soft environment when it comes to the press conference. It's all like UFC 270, whatever, whoa, big drama show, da da da, and then just keep the show rolling. We're not on about examining their practices on UFC turf, at least.
And the last thing, Jim, that I wanted to ask you about Jaime Munguia, who fought last weekend, another guy that's kind of unranked, and you know, I think he's had a lot of these fights in his very young career, but also very prolific career as well. I think he's, what, 39-0, still only 25 years of age, but he's now in contention for the championship, championship fights in the WBC, which Jamal Charlo currently holds. Also, he's ranked up in the WBO, which Demetrius Andrade holds. And I think he's on about potentially moving up to 165 and possibly vacating the belt. So there could be an opportunity for Munguia to finally get like a title shot at the vacant belt.
Well, he's already a champion in the 154 pound division. I'm just going through his resume right now. He's got wins over Liam Smith, Saddam Ali back to back. Those are the two names that stand out, really. It's, as you say, high numbers, probably underwhelming name value in opposition. Gabe Rosado, actually, that stands out as a very good win. Gabe Rosado is he's a tough cookie to crack. But that's before Rosado moved up to 168, where he's achieved big things, really. Should have probably got the win against Danny Jacobs before his recent loss against John Ryder. And he knocked out this Russian kid with a bowl haircut who was supposed to be the next big thing. Absolutely wiped him out in the second round. So, listen, this guy is still only 25 years old. 3 or 4 years ago, before HBO pulled out of boxing, they were touting this guy to be the opponent for Gennady Golovkin before they got out of there. Golovkin moved to the zone and whatever. So that suggests to me that there's been eyes on him for a long time. And it's almost like a Mexican way of doing things. If you turn pro young, just rack up the pro appearances. Just knock out as many as you can. Look at Canelo. Look, famous example would be Julio Cesar Chavez back in the day. 100 some fucking wins versus like 10 losses or something by the end. Ridiculous record. That's like a 1920s fighter. This guy is fucking massive for middleweight. He's huge. And he looks like he filled back into the weight like quite badly. There was like saggy flesh around him and all that. If he gets a nutritionist that's like better than the one he's got now by appearances, and he continues to fight at the same frequency, he can do a lot of damage at 160 and 168. Mm-hmm. He's definitely big enough to go up to super middleweight, maybe even light heavyweight, and claim titles there. It's just a matter of, you know, who is he going to fight? We're talking the Charlos, maybe Jared Hurd, maybe what's his name now? J-Rock, Julian Williams. A middleweight, yeah. The sky's the limit for him, 25, unless he fights himself into a bit of a rut and wear and tear. I think you mentioned the other day, 7 fights in a calendar year at one point. I think he's already balled himself down. Let's have a look at his resume recently. Since 2020, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 fights since 2020 in the middle of a pandemic as well. This kid wants to get out there. I think he can do big things, and I wouldn't. It's hard to pick against him because he's a volume puncher with a good chin and size on his side and a good engine that will overcome most fighters at the top level, to be honest with you.
And at that age, how much does having that amount of experience, and obviously he fought in his hometown again, sellout crowd, I think 15,000 there. Do you think that has a massive, massive impact on the potential, or how far he can take his potential, and whether he can hold one of the big titles in the future?
Oh, he definitely can. Experience is everything. You know, he's been in there with fighters who I rate, but he's also been in there with a lot of fighters who I've never heard of. If you feel comfortable in the ring and you're big, you're strong, you back your own chin, you're willing to throw punches, the fucking sky's the limit. It's the name of the game, isn't it? You know, I honestly. Say, who's a good 160, 168 fighter we've got over here right now? Say, Chris Eubank Jr. Jaime Munguia would beat the living fuck out of Chris Eubank Jr. Absolutely. That's a one-sided beatdown. So that's the guy who says, I'm going up to fight Golovkin, this, that, and the other. That is not a fight, as far as I'm concerned. You won't hear Eubank Jr. calling his name. No way. What's in it for you? 12 rounds of fucking pain, mate. That's it. So
it's really interesting. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, we're anyone who's interested in that kind of high octane performances. The other night, I didn't think he boxed that well, but he was just way too much for your man, wasn't he? As soon as he landed, the fight was over. Definitely put a pin in Jaime Munguia because he's going to be around for a long time, barring like tragic circumstances or whatever.
Yeah, let's keep an eye on him. All right, I think that's about it for this week then.
We managed to not let the war pervade our conversations, but I feel like we should have gave a bit more mention. But I was going to quiz you at the beginning, Flynn, about your general knowledge on the Ukrainian-Russia conflict, but I'm glad it didn't seep into the fabric of the episode, really, because it's fucking depressing, isn't it? Really.
It is, and everyone who's listening to this will be ahead of what we're going to talk about it. But anyway, they're hearing it from everywhere, from every time they put on the TV or the radio or anything, so And our job's not to give them the news about the war. It's sport, isn't it?
Yeah, it's our job to get the sports news incorrect and
and give our famous terrible bad take.
Yeah, exactly. Baker by trade, mate.
It was interesting listening to ESPN this week though, and one of the shows and one of the guys that leads it, he opened up with the show by saying that, look, you know, sport is, it's minuscule in comparison to what's going on over in Ukraine at the moment and what's happening with Russia. But he was like, sport is massive in our minds and in that select few people that are interested in sport. It's everything to us in that moment. So it's like, all we can do is just continue talking about sport because that's what we love. And it's, you know, we're not going to let it overshadow any of the events, but he just wanted to make sure that was put out there. And I think that's the fairest way you can do it, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I can't argue 100%. With that at all, man. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, nobody takes it lightly what's going on, but at the end of the day, the world's going to keep revolving and sport's going to keep on reeling if Dana White's got any choice in the matter.
He'll be the last man standing, man.
You know what I mean? He'll still be putting on cards, like, do you know what I mean? Like, when the world's on the brink, and nuclear warheads have been dropped, he'll still be looking to put on a card in
live from Mars.
UFC 291 from Antarctica. It's in the smoldering wreckages of the last vestiges of planet Earth.
All right, so lads,
been a pleasure.
Cheers. Have a good weekend.